We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
What is up, everybody, and welcome to the All-NBA Show, part of the All City Podcast Network. I'm your host, Adam Mades. I'm in an undisclosed location, although you could probably figure it out, DNVR Studio B. And I'm joined by my esteemed colleague, Tim Legler. Legs, it's March Madness, man. Great time of year.
March Madness, best time of year. You got NBA, you know, winding down their season. You got what's about to happen for the next 3 weeks with the NCAA basketball. And by the way, men and women, I'm just as stoked to watch the women this year. I can't wait. I got everything set up to make sure I'm going to be available to watch Caitlin Clark play as many games as she plays. That's going to be first priority. So if we come on here a couple days, and I don't know what's going on in the NBA, but I can talk Caitlin Clark if you want to kill a half hour on that. Yeah. I'm going to be locked in there. And then you got the Masters right around the corner, man. So I love this time of year, believe me.
Are you a golf guy?
Yes, and I was starting to become pretty avid, and I was, like, dedicated. One of the reasons, like, we moved to Florida and bought a property on there was because I wanted to really, for the first time in my life, take it really seriously, like, take lessons and – hone in and, like, just really take it to another level. And now I've got a 27-month-old son. So that's kind of put that on the kibosh. I see my golf clubs a lot in the garage. They look at me. They ask me if I remember them. I've not had a lot of time to play. I will get there at some point. But yes, to answer your question, I love it. I absolutely love watching the majors too. I'll be locked in for 4 days watching that.
I have a theory that all shooters are great golfers. Steph Curry is a great golfer. J.R. Smith is a great golfer. It's like those two skills, even though they're completely different, somehow they're the same. They require the same talent.
Well, here's what I will tell you. I'm not a great golfer. I plan on becoming one. I am a great putter. So there is a correlation there, right? With touch and depth perception and all that. Like there is a correlation there. But I will say this. Pat myself on the back. My wife would be here. If she was here, she would attest to this. I'm really good at anything that requires, like, throwing something into an object. Like, I'm really good at cornhole. Like, I'm really good dart thrower. Beer pong. I've not a whole lot of people are going to take me on a beer pong table. So if you got an object and it has to be thrown into another object, I'm pretty good at that. So I think there was a correlation with shooting a basketball.
I take pride in my cornhole game as well. So I think in Summer League in Vegas, I think we're going to have a little face-off, Legs. We'll see what happens.
Lock me in. Sign me up, brother. I'm in. No doubt.
Let's do it. On today's show, guys, we're going to talk about the Boston Celtics, Milwaukee Bucks. No Giannis, so a little wind out of the sails of this game, but there's still some interesting things that happened. And we'll use it as an opportunity to talk about the Celtics and just ask, are they a different team right now than they were in October? They've been having a great year. They've been very consistent all year. So is that just, you know, have they grown at all? We'll talk about that. We also had a very interesting Heat-Cavs finish. We'll talk about that game and what takeaways we have from that one. And then later in the show, we will talk a little March Madness, not necessarily about the college teams, but we're going to talk about the college NBA relationship and how it's changed over the years. Is it a good thing, a bad thing? We'll do some favorite memories of March Madness and hear some throwback Thursday stories from Legler. But first, we are presented as always by DraftKings. Stay tuned because you'll hear more about DraftKings and all they have to offer throughout the show. DraftKings, the crown is yours. All right, Legs, let's start with the Celtics beating the Bucks. This score, 122-119, makes it sound like it was a very close game. That's a one-possession game. And indeed, it was a one-possession game because the Celtics do what they do a lot, cough up leads or not perform well in the clutch. The Bucks and Damian Lillard in particular does what he does a lot, which is make a lot of threes when the game is over. I was thinking about this, Legs, and I'll start with this even though it's not the top story. I think Lillard is the best player in the NBA down 15 with 5 minutes to go.
But see, that sounds like on its face, I knew where you were about to go as soon as you started to say that. Well, you set it up by saying he made a bunch of threes with the game over, and I knew where you were going to go when you said that. That sounds like a pretty significant insult. Like, that sounds like an insulting thing to say.
I'm not trying to mean it as an insult, sincerely.
Well, if somebody, you know, came up to anybody and say, hey, man, you're great when there's no chance to win. I love that about you, man. That sounds like the ultimate insult to me. I don't know. But I know you didn't mean it that way, so I'll let you expand upon that.
What I mean is he's such a great – and it actually is an interesting point because it's what we've talked about with him in Milwaukee the whole season, which is he's adjusting to the team he's on. How aggressive should he be? There's questions he never had to ask of himself with how aggressive he needs to be in a game. But even when he was in Portland, when it was like, hey, it's desperation time, no thought, you're going to be pulling up, you know, crossover, pull up three, deep three from 10 feet behind the line, whatever it is, when your brain turns off and you just become in that flow state, he's so good at it. And oftentimes you can only get there when your back is against the wall and there's no other options. And that's what I mean. So I'm not judging, I don't mean it as an insult. Last night he had, I don't know, five threes in the last 5 minutes or something. And they were all impossible threes, like really tough threes. But he just seems to be really good when his mind can go to that space.
Well, I'll even add a component to it because I think there's some truth in what you're saying. I also think, and I've said this before, you know, he has that untethered feeling when Giannis doesn't play. And when Giannis plays, you know, it's still something, I think, that is not natural for Damian Lillard to not just come up the court every time, knowing that, like, pretty much whatever you want to do, you can do. When you're playing with a guy that good and you're not even the best player on your own team, which he's not regarded as anymore, that means there's a little bit of thought process that goes into that, right? There's a little bit of deference there that you play with that's just not straight raw instincts. And that's how he played his entire career in Portland. So whether they were down, up, whatever, it was always his show. And so when Giannis doesn't play, he probably feels that way again. And he just looks more like the Damian Lillard we saw in Portland. And what they haven't quite figured out, they've gotten better at it. And look, their defense has improved. That's been pretty dramatic with them. Like, they're definitely playing harder defensively. There's more accountability there defensively. They still, I don't think, have really reached their ceiling offensively with those two players. And I think that if that's still a little bit, if there's another 10% there that they can figure out how to grab in terms of efficiency, you've narrowed the gap with a team like Boston to where now you have an interesting conversation, I think. But for me, I still think it's clearly Boston is a better team. And that's the one thing left, I think, for Milwaukee, trying to figure out how to have nights where both of those guys are good and not just like, you know, every other night or whatever, but like every night in a series against the Celtics, how do you get maximum out of both players? I don't think they've really figured that out quite yet. I think it's more because of Lillard being in a unique situation for him where he's playing with someone that casts a shadow as large as Giannis Antetokounmpo's. I just think he plays a little bit differently when he's on the court with a little bit more, I guess, foot on the brake a little bit. And when he's not there, he doesn't. And that's when he looks like he did last night. Now, they were down when he made some of those shots, but I've seen games this year where they had to have all of them throughout the game, and he did it when Giannis didn't play too.
And, you know, he didn't have a great night. He had a great fourth quarter, 32 points, 11 of 21. And I actually thought the Celtics and Jaylen Brown in particular did a really good job defensively on him, which is a note that I have because when you get in these matchups, and again, with no Giannis, everything's thrown off. So you don't want to read too much into it. But you do want to look at and say, hey, how do the certain matchups, how do teams guard you? Who takes the matchup and how do they do? And that one to me, like, that was a very impressive defensive effort from Jaylen Brown for most of this game, and it was one of the top stories. But if I had to give a single top story from the game, it's Peyton Pritchard. What a game from him. The stint he had in the first quarter, start of second quarter, he was 7 of 11. He goes 19.6 rebounds, 3 assists on the game. But that stretch, it just he changed the energy. You're playing at home. The crowd was into it. And the final heat check he had, like 5 crossovers in a row into a step back. He's not a tall guy. He has to get it off quick. That was a hell of a move. And I know he doesn't have that every night. He has that energy every night, but he could be a little hit or miss, obviously, with his shot making. But last night, him making shots is what made this not a game for most of the game.
You know, a couple of things I don't think come through when you watch Peyton Pritchard on TV that you see when you get to see him in person and you're down by the court and you get to really see. Number one is he's listed at 6'1". That's doubtful. I don't think there's any way Peyton Pritchard is 6'1". He's shorter than that. And two, I don't think you can appreciate his quickness until you see it up close. Because he's smaller, that quickness doesn't always necessarily translate into like the type of separation when you're watching the game visually to understand a guy that size, how quick you have to be to get any space to get shots off on the perimeter or get shots off on drive to the rim. And he's a good finisher. Like, he does stuff at the basket. He's not just camped out around a 3-point line. Like, he is attacking all the time and breaking guys down. And like, as fast as his feet move, like, it, you can hear his sneakers on the court more than any other player when he's going. So I agree with you. Like, I'm a huge fan of his. I have been from the beginning. I was a little confused at the start of the year because I felt like they'd paid him, and then they were still like kind of reluctant to like just let him go at times in the games. I felt like he was still kind of like wasn't able to play through as many like mistakes or misses as he is now. And he is so comfortable right now. He's a fan favorite. He's one of those guys that generates a lot of electricity with anything he does. It's worth more than just that one particular stat. It's worth more than that to your team because the crowd reacts to it differently and it gives your whole team juice. So I thought he was sensational. I like what you said about the defense on Lillard because I was noticing that. So you got no Drew Holiday and the luxury of you lose Drew Holiday. He's an all league defensive type guard. There's been years he's been one of a guy that could win defensive player of the year multiple times. Like he's in that category. So, all right, we take him off the floor. Oh, that's nice. We go to Jaylen Brown, who is almost every bit as athletic laterally as Drew Holiday, but he's a lot bigger and stronger, and he's committed to it. So he's guarding Lillard. And then, by the way, if you're on a ball screen switch, oh, now who gets him? Derek White, another elite-level guard defender, or Tatum. And then there was even possessions last night. Al Horford jumped out, switched, and was denying him all the way out to half court and just making him work harder. So Boston's defensive approach toward him I thought was really good. So credit Lillard. He started with 32. With that level of defensive pressure, without another star, you know, to take the burden off you. And again, Bobby Portis was the guy that helped them out. It's amazing how Bobby Portis strings together these outbursts that give the Bucks a chance in some games where you don't think they're going to.
This is the second time, it's the second time I remember in the last week where Bobby Portis has had one of those outbursts. So maybe we shouldn't dismiss it. I don't know. He seems to play better when Giannis is out. So I want to go real quickly just back to Peyton Pritchard here because he played 31 minutes tonight, more than even Porzingis, say, for example. And he's one of those guys that every team has these X factors where, to me, I look at him and I go, is that a strength or a weakness on any given night? Peyton Pritchard, to me, is that. He's a very good player. And when he's a strength, I think they win by 20. He's like he can swing a game. But he's not – when we go into a playoffs – he's not a guy that I look at and say, oh, the Miami Heat, you know who's going to win them that series? Peyton Pritchard. So I'm just kind of curious, how volatile do you feel he is as a player? And then also, what do you think his upside is this year, like right now, as an impact piece in the playoffs?
Huge. I think huge going forward. I think he's broken through any sort of barrier that he had. Mm-hmm. I think now when he plays, you're expecting these types of performances. Now, look, he's not going to play 31 minutes too often. You know, he got more minutes last night because Drew Holiday didn't play. He's gonna consistently be, I think, north of 20. And his numbers now and his shooting numbers have been off the charts. He's shooting almost 50% from the field in the month of March and 45% from the three. And it's not like a small sample size. He's had games where he's taking 9 threes. He's had games where he takes 4 or 5. Like that's like a normal night. That's a lot of threes for a guy off the bench, and he's shooting 45% from out there. He's also, by the way, an exceptional on-ball pressure defender.
Right.
And he's one of those guys that picks guys up three-quarter court. And those two or three turns that you make a point guard have to do or change direction up to half court or up to where you get into the scoring area, that stuff matters. And that's one of the reasons that coaches value guys like Payton Pritchard, because very few guys want to do it, are good enough to do it, athletic enough to do it. He is an absolute irritant defensively. Yep. The way that he slides his feet and stays in front. Now, eventually, you know, he can, if you get enough dribbles on him, you can overpower him a little bit just because of your sheer height and maybe shoot right over him. But that doesn't happen too often to him. Like, he is so good and strong enough to keep the ball in front and keep it out of the lane. So that's another element to his game where he has massive, massive help, quantitative help. Even on a night when he doesn't get a lot of shots, he's still helping you because of what he does defensively and the pressure he puts on ball handlers that will have an attrition to it over the course of the time he's on the court.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah. So the headline for this show was, you know, have the Celtics changed? I have a couple ways I think that they have throughout the year, how they've grown. But I'm going to start with one where I don't know if they have grown. And that is that for whatever reason, in the clutch, they become the slowest, most deliberate, obvious team in the league. And it happened again last night where, and I think this is the nature of how they play, a lot of isolation, a lot of three-point shots, a lot of slashing. You do that freely, and then when the game gets close, it's like, okay, we have to maximize possession. Well, that's what you were doing all game. You were maximizing possession by playing freely. Last night, again, this didn't feel like a close game until, like, it just felt like a slow bleed. But as that was happening, the possessions were 12 seconds of somebody standing at the top of the key dribbling, everybody just standing still, wasting the clock. And then you go into an ISO that has no time for a kick out, no time for anything. It's just go. And this is what the Celtics do all the time. And the fact that they did it last night against the Bucks team when the game was already put away with no Giannis, to me, I look at that and I go, that's one way where this team seems to not even be trying to change their identity in those moments. Am I being too hard on this?
A little bit from this standpoint, and particularly let's just focus on last night. I do think this is a topic and a theme that is relevant to the Celtics. And I do think it's something we're going to continue to talk about. And we will definitely have a moment in the playoffs early where we talk about this exact thing. Like, man, they slowed it down so much and they become easier to guard and the shot selection becomes more difficult. And like, why are you playing that way when you just play faster and move the ball, nobody can guard you. We will be talking about this, but last night, I really believe this. If you go back and really look at all those possessions in the fourth quarter when this lead dissipated and got down to a three-point game, they had some clean looks that they didn't bang. And they do. They had some corner threes. Porzingis had one. Derek White had one. Jaylen Brown had a miss in the paint. Like, really high-quality look. Peyton Pritchard missed one. If they make those couple of those shots, they win this game by 12, 15 points. Because that's what's going to happen. The Bucks would have come down, taken a quick one. Celtics rebound it, you know, maybe get fouled a couple times. And it's a 15-point game. And so I think now we can over-scrutinize because those balls didn't go in. But to your point, they do ISO too much in those situations. And even last night, miraculously, somehow, the Bucks get that to 3 points. Bobby Portis makes a couple of threes. It's a three-point game. And what does Boston go to 2 times in a row? Jason Tatum isolation. And he bailed
delivered.
Him out
because he
got fouled the first time, banged 2 free throws, and then he went one-on-one against Beasley and had a really nice finish with his left hand, you know, at the rim over some shot blockers. So he delivered, and just like that, it's a 7-point game, game over. But it was ISO. It wasn't like they came down and ran some sort of set. I like some of their initial ball screen action, their flare action that they run to get them into something quickly, where now you can attack downhill. they tend to put the ball in one guy's hand and play, and it's usually Tatum, and they just kind of let him go. And I do think you are making yourself easier to guard and making yourself more vulnerable, and your margin for error shrinks when you play that way. So I do think there's something to it, but I thought last night that Boston just has to make like two open shots in a like a 4-minute stretch, and that's going to end up being a double-digit game over the last minute.
You're not wrong that there were opportunities. It's more, though, to me, like the soul of who you are in those moments. And what I mean by that is every team has to make a calculation between how much risk you're willing to take on any given possession. If you don't take any risk, you oftentimes aren't going to get good shots, right? You can play it safe. They seem to be fine with risk throughout most of the game. And at the end of the game, they put that scale, in my opinion, too far. We're going to run the clock. We're going to waste the first 14 seconds of this possession. We're not going to make too many passes because we don't want to turn over. And that scale, it definitely moves towards safety in the clutch. You become more risk averse in the clutch, but all teams do. But I just think they slide it a little bit too far. And it's something that happened again last night, even though they got good shots. All right, let's talk about the way they have changed, though. I was thinking about this last night as I was watching it. One of the most impressive moments of the game for me was the offensive rebound Porzingis grabbed with about a minute to go. It was a huge one.
That was a sensational rebound.
And if I have a critique of Porzingis, it's that I don't think he makes winning plays throughout his career. I just don't know that he always makes those. That was a winning play. And I've actually noticed a lot of winning plays from him over the last, couple of months. And I think that is one thing that early in the season when I watched him, I thought somewhat of the same old Porzingis, likes the easy stuff, likes the finesse stuff you can get in his head. I feel like he has grown throughout the year. Maybe he's even noticed that and like, hey, this team needs me to make an offensive rebound with 1 minute to go. Those are the plays I'm going to have to provide this team. And I don't know. Maybe you agree, maybe you don't. But I feel like Porzingis has become more of a winning player this year than I've ever seen.
I think that's an astute observation. I think, listen, when you're part of a team that's this good, right, you can – everything you do is magnified in a positive way, right? And that's just the way it is. Your numbers can drop. Right? You can be a guy that averaged 23 somewhere else and average 18 on this team, right? And it's significantly more important because of what you're playing for. The stakes are so much higher. You're held to a higher standard. And so I think that's kind of the situation Porzingis finds himself in. The other area I think he's better at, when he gets those switches, when he sets a screen and they switch a guard onto him, he's much better at getting into that, that 12 to 15 foot area, putting his hand up, catching it, and then getting the shot he wants. When you would watch him earlier in his career, he'd get the switch and he would end up taking these lean back fall away shots. He now turns into those smaller defenders and shoots an on balance 12 foot jump shot when the defender's coming up to his chin and he's just shooting over the top and he's unfazed by it. He wouldn't do that before. So I think that's another area that he has improved. But I think the biggest area of improvement, and this is saying a lot because this guy's already been a really good player for a long time in this league, Jaylen Brown is at a completely different level as a player now, in my opinion.
He's the other guy. Those are the two guys, Brown and Porzingis.
Brown is there's just something about him now and the way he's carrying himself and the certainty with which he's playing, and his numbers back it up. I mean, he's averaging almost 30 points a game this month. He's over 50% from the field, over 40% from the three. I still do think he does have a little bit of susceptibility at the line late, and he missed two last night. It doesn't look like it flows when he's in a pressure situation. He definitely looks like he's holding onto the ball too long, like trying to guide it in. So I think if there's one thing about him in late game situations, that might be a little bit something we watch in the playoffs as a comeback to bite them, that he's not, doesn't seem too sure of himself at the line, but in every other aspect of his game, he has improved this year. He's better with either hand. He makes more plays passing that are difficult passes for him in the past that would have been tipped or not made at all. He would have picked it up and not made the pass. He's better at that. He's just better at getting the shot he wants. He's always been an elite level athlete. He's been like explosive, sort of a spurt type of scorer. Now he's so consistently good throughout the game and he's always competing on the other end. I just think that he's 27 years old, man. And I think sometimes around 25, 26, it really starts to kick in. And it's kicking in right now for Jaylen Brown because what you're watching is the best version Jaylen Brown has been as an NBA player. And that is why I have more faith in this team because I still have a little bit doubt about Jason Tatum. Like in a pressure situation against the Denver in the NBA Finals, is How's he going to perform? You know what? I got news for you. He doesn't have to be as great as I thought he did, because Jaylen Brown's going to make up for some of that slack now because of the level he's playing. I mean, he's outscored Jason Tatum, I believe, over the last 6 weeks. He's been their leading scorer. And that's the extent to which, like, this is now a true partnership. And we talked about this earlier in the week. It's a partnership. And it didn't feel that way before, right? It kind of felt like it was that Batman and Robin situation, right? Where it was still like the CEO and then, you know, the guy that's like working for him. That's not what it feels like now. It feels like both guys can take the reins and they're equally sharing responsibility in the ultimate outcome for this team. And that's why I think it's a very good thing for Jason Tatum. And it just speaks volumes about Jaylen Brown continuing to work on his game, even now deeper into his career.
Yeah, and I'm gonna take it a step further even, because you used an interesting phrase to open this up, saying that Jaylen Brown is carrying himself different, because I think this is half of it. Teams take on the identity of their best player, and oftentimes best players, and obviously Denver's the team I'm covering most closely, so I'm going to say Jokic is the team's best player. He's quiet. He's calm. The team carries his calmness, for sure. He's unselfish. They carry his unselfishness. Jamal Murray is the team's second best player and the running mate. He has bravado. He has confidence. He has swagger. The team absorbs those. Those are traits that maybe Jokic doesn't have, and they absorb those ones. So the team kind of has the energy of both players, and they get behind them, and they feel that. I think that what you're talking about and what I observe of this team over the back half of the season is they are absorbing him now into their culture, because he plays with this intensity, this like accepting every challenge, this toughness to him that I've questioned about the Celtics, and they seem to have more of that. Peyton Pritchard provided a lot of that as well last night off the bench, which is awesome. But I think Jaylen Brown taking on these tough assignments every single night, playing as tough and with as much confidence as he does in the clutch. We talked about him going to the basket. They're a team that I think can settle for a lot of threes late in games because, you know, you get to your spot, you take it. He will attack the basket and get downhill. So I think that, to me, that's what we're talking about, is they have now – they are obviously Tatum's the best player, but he is right there to where the culture is both of those two guys now.
Yeah, that's very well summed up, and it's been really fun to watch Jaylen Brown, you know, because you think about it, Jaylen Brown every year for the last 3 years has like been mentioned in trade rumors, and it's like he's carried that with him the whole time, and I think now you never say never, but it's like he's carrying himself like he is. He's beyond that. I'm beyond that now. Like, this is who I am as a player. And a lot of nights, that means I can be the best player on this team. And over the last, like, 6 weeks, you can make a really strong argument. He has been. And that's why I think Boston just continues to do what they do. Last night, that really should have been a 15- or 20-point win. It got real interesting late. But overall, another very impressive performance out of the Celtics.
They are 47-7 when they make 15 threes or more. First of all, 15 is a lot, and they have that many games. 47-7, that's obviously a huge key for them. I will say one thing that happened late in this game when you were talking about Tatum. I think with Tatum, you can't give him space. And I thought Milwaukee, I mean, what do we question? We question their backcourt and whether or not Malik Beasley is going to be able to take on a lot of these assignments in the clutch. And last night, I actually thought he battled and competed. To your point, Tatum made some impressive moves going to the basket. But one thing I watched that frustrates me is Tatum at the top of the key, at the three-point line, not like deep up the three-point line, at the three-point line, and the defense is letting him play with the ball. And I just think he's a guy, if we think about what does Boston want, they want to run that clock to end the clutch, they're going slow, speed them up. If they're uncomfortable being sped up, get into him. Don't let him get his rhythm dribbles, because he was 10 seconds of rhythm dribble, get into a shot, and he was comfortable doing that. So that was one thing I noticed, but with Milwaukee, the big question is obviously, can those guys defend? Last night, even though they made the comeback, watching when things got tight and how comfortable Tatum was getting to his spots, I thought that's not going to be a challenge for him in the playoffs, in my opinion, getting past those guys.
No, and they went zone part of that second half because they didn't have a choice. They just weren't guarding them. So they went zone, and it had some success initially. First two, three possessions, Boston was a little bit out of sync. They didn't get great looks. Milwaukee cut into the lead a little bit, but then like the next three trips, Boston scored on it, and then they got out of it. But then they went back to it again in the fourth quarter, or when they had to cut into the deficit. And it's something I heard on the broadcast, they said that Doc has used zone fourth most amount since he took the job in Milwaukee in the league. And that's just something else to think about. Now, you wouldn't think zone would be super effective against a team that thrives at the three-point line, But when you can go zone, you can affect the rhythm of how you get those shots. Because when they're at their best, that ball is hitting the paint and then it's coming out and then they're making you chase the ball. That's when it's at the, or in transition. So zone, if you can get back and set up, take away the transition three and affect them in a way where now they can still take threes, but they're not getting them the same way. It maybe can be effective, something to look for down the road if these two end up in a playoff series.
Quickly before we move on, I don't really have any thoughts on the Bucks. I mean, the one thing is we've talked about it before, but they continue to set screens so high up at the court. They had a double screen on Lillard late in this game that took place at half court. Not usually it's at the circle at half court or a little bit below. This one was at half court. That was my only note. But when they don't have Giannis, I just don't know how much we can read into a game. I don't want to make overreactions to a game when Giannis isn't there. But do you have any thoughts about them and their side of things?
I do. One other thing I've noticed that and I don't know why it happens on given nights, but Brooke Lopez some nights is a complete non-factor offensively. And when they, if you think about how good they have been over the past several years, if you feel like when they're really playing well offensively, making runs, like Brooke Lopez is a weapon for them. He's a weapon because number one, like he draws shot blockers away from the basket. It's hard to get to him. He's 7 feet one. So he's shooting it really high. So like he can shoot it even with dudes right in his face, like on a closeout or a rotation. He goes up all slow, same motion because he's so big. He's not bothered by it. And he makes shots. And he seems like he's always like in the middle of these big runs the Bucks have had over the last few years. And you look up, and I'm looking at his shot chart right now for the month of March. Adam, he's got 2, 5, 7 games out of the 9 where he's taken 8 shots or fewer. And in like 5 of those, he's taken 5 shots or fewer. And it's like they forget about what a weapon he is. And he's so important to them, I think. He also, by the way, can score in the post if he gets a switch. And right. He's a good offensive rebounder that can hurt you that way. But there are some nights I'm so used to watching him have like where he'll take, you know, these important threes like throughout the game that nobody can really get to because he can shoot it whenever he wants. And I noticed last night, I didn't even notice Brooke Lopez played. And I looked up because at the morning I was like, wow, 21 minutes. Would never have guessed that he was even out there. And he took 5 shots, you know, and this is happening more and more frequently. And I just feel like that's something that the Bucks need to be cognizant of, man. He's a weapon that is very hard to deal with when you're trying to deal with Giannis and Dame and Beasley and getting to him in the corners. Brooke Lopez has all that space up front. And they need to use him a little bit more, man, and put teams in situations where that's a difficult rotation. Because I just think that he's too important to them offensively to be forgotten about.
It's funny that these teams haven't really played each other at full strength because it's going to be a great matchup. The Bucks' year has been so weird that they're two different teams, you know, the pre-Doc and post-Doc team anyway. But I just feel like we're going to get into a playoffs without a really good read of what this matchup looks like.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm not trying to Celtics fans are going to get mad at me for saying this. I'm not trying to take anything away from the Celtics. They haven't had the chance to prove it, against that Bucks team.
For the year, I didn't look at the schedule. Are they done?
I actually don't know. Let me look. But I'm even wondering, you're at the point now where you look at Boston's lead so big that even if they play again, they do play the fourth to last game, April 9th, fourth to last game. But, I mean, Boston will be done by that time. Do you show your hand? Do you do anything? I have no idea. All right, let's take a break. On the other side, let's get to the Heat and the Cavs game. And let's talk about that one because that one had a great finish and almost an insane buzzer beater. We'll get to that one and also talk some NCAA March Madness on the other side. But first, let me tell you guys about the Game Time app. What are you getting into this weekend? It's Thursday. It's time to start making some weekend plans. Is there a game you want to go check out? Is there a concert or event in your area? Well, just hop on the Game Time app. By the way, even if you don't know what's going on, you can just open up the Game Time app and find out because that's one way for you to find out what the major events are in your area. They have the flash deals, the zone deals, last-minute tickets. You can sort by type of event. Are you looking for a sports event? Are you looking for a concert? Really great searchable way to kind of figure out your weekend plans. And they also have my favorite feature, which is that all-in pricing button right on the front page. You push that, and then you get you become aware of exactly what the final price will be when you go to checkout. No surprises. Takes the guesswork out of buying tickets with Game Time. Here's what you want to do. Download the Game Time app, create an account, and use code ALLNBA for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply. Again, create an account, redeem code ALLNBA for $20 off. Download Game Time today. Last-minute tickets, lowest prices guaranteed. Also want to tell you guys about DraftKings Sportsbook. The show is brought to you by DraftKings Sportsbook. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code ALLNBA. March Madness is upon us. It's already going. As soon as we're done with this show, I'm going down. I'm in the DNVR bar right now, our studio above the DNVR bar. I'm going down. I'm hopping on a live stream, and I'm going to be live for 7 straight hours watching March Madness and placing bets down there. It's going to be a great time. Right now, new customers have a shot to turn $5 into $150 instantly in bonus bets with any college basketball bet. And why not make a bet on college basketball? Hop on March Madness. This is the thing about March Madness. You don't have to know more than the expert covering the game. You can pick any team, any upset, and you have great odds of it happening. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code ALLNBA. New customers can bet $5, get $150 instantly in bonus bets only at DraftKings Sportsbook with code ALLNBA. The crown is yours.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas, 21 and over, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.com/promos for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources.
Back here on the ALLNBA show, if you're enjoying the show, hit that like button. Don't forget to leave a comment if you're watching late, and also subscribe. You can listen to us in the car, on the go, in the garage, wherever it is. If you don't catch us live, we are on Spotify, we are on Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. All right, Legs, the other game we want to talk about today, the Miami Heat beat the Cleveland Cavaliers. This game came down to the wire as well, had some big-time shot-making both from Jimmy Butler and Terry Rozier, and very nearly had an incredible Leitner-esque, I know it's March Madness, we almost had a Leitner-esque full court pass, one pitch, and then Garland got a shot off at the buzzer, a deep three, and it looked like it was going in, just barely missed it. What stood out to you about this game?
More than anything else, it's what Terry Rozier did down the stretch. He had a four-point play and then a sidestep three that basically won the game. And that's just so important. When they picked him up, I thought that was a massive addition for them because they needed just more punch. They needed more firepower, particularly, you know, on those nights, those odd nights when, you know, Jimmy Butler doesn't look all that interested in scoring. Last night he did, by the way. He came out right from the beginning. He had a different mindset. He was very aggressive. It's so obvious when you watch Jimmy Butler play. It's like he thought about it in the locker room when he's sitting there listening to music. You know, I think I'm going to come out and shoot early tonight. It's just like the weirdest thing to me. I'll never understand it. But anyway, he did it last night, and we saw a really good version of Jimmy Butler. But it was the late shot-making from Rozier. Two step-back threes. Well, one step-back and one sidestep. Two totally different shots, really. Both over Okoro. One's a four-point play. One's just to create space right in front of the Cavs bench that won the game. I just think it's so important, Adam. You know, they're definitely a dangerous team. We know that. You know that the Heat are going to be a team that's going to make you earn everything if you have to play them in a series. And to have Terry Rozier, you know, feeling better about himself offensively and looking more like the guy that he was in Charlotte at his best, really important. So that's back-to-back 20-point games. I think it's the first time since he's been there that that's happened. And the fact that he had the ball late in the game, and he was the one, even on a night when Jimmy Butler, you know, had it rolling, had 19 shots to get 30 points, super efficient night, they went with Rozier, and they went with ball screens getting switches and then operating against it and being perfectly fine, not going to Jimmy in like a mid-ISO area, like in a game-deciding moment. And so that, to me, is definitely the number one thing that stood out. So first, I'll get your thoughts on that before I talk a little bit about the Cavs' late game management.
Well, to me, it's the most interesting thing about Miami right now is, you know, how Rozier fits into him. And you're right. If you go through Rozier's game log since joining the Heat, I think he had one 10-point game in the first five or six. Like, he really started slow. And then it's okay. Every night it's 11 to 15 points, then 15 to 20. And now, to your point, the last two games, two 20-point games. I'm looking at box scores on this. As I mentioned, I watched Miami maybe every fifth or sixth game. But, you know, just looking at that looks like a trend. And then watching him last night, the shots he was taking, those were old Terry Rozier shots where they were no, yes shots. But Miami needs no, yes guys because they're going to get stops. They need guys to get buckets. And last night, when I was watching that game last night, my thought was, or watching the fourth quarter, I was thinking, that's a version of Miami that can actually win. You've got guys like Butler, you've got guys like Hero, and you got a guy like Rozier. three shot makers that can break great defense at any given moment and demoralize you. And if you have three of them, that's what you need in a playoffs if you're not a great like half-court system offensive team.
No doubt. Look, this is an impressive win for them. And I know that Cleveland didn't have Mitchell, but you're talking about going up against, you know, Jared Allen in the front line. You don't have Bam, right? So, I mean, that's a big win for Miami. At this stage of the year, they're all important, but I think the way that they won the game and the way they executed late was really important. And from Cleveland's standpoint, you know, Niang had some big moments for them to get them back in the game because they were down almost double figures in the fourth quarter. Niang played, but he also missed a couple of wide open corner threes that could have been major difference makers. But overall, I can't blame him. He had a big impact in this game in the fourth quarter. But they had a really interesting possession, Adam. It's tied up 100-100, 1 minute to go. The weirdest thing. So I know Mitchell's not playing, but you still have Darius Garland. You still have Caris LeVert. And they ended up in this situation with Niang and Okoro somehow after a made free throw, by the way. When Miami went back on defense, and then a couple guys kind of came into the backcourt to, like, lurk with fake pressure. But all of a sudden, Okoro and Niang are, like, back there, like, Keystone Cops trying to figure out how to advance the ball, and they almost lose it twice. They finally get it over half court. LeVert then runs all the way out to half court to, like, get the ball, and the shot clock is at, like, 11, and they haven't done anything yet. And then he proceeds to operate. He gets into the lane. I think because he got the ball so late, he lost track of the clock. They have a 24-second violation, like in that situation, inside of a minute, 40 seconds to go, or not even 35 seconds to go, they have a shot clock violation in a tie game. And it just was like, wow, that was a major, major play in the game. Butler hits a shot, Jared Allen ties it up, and then Terry Rozier has the heroics late. But I just thought the way that Miami kind of hung in there in one of these gut check games was important that they won this game, and is really important what Terry Rozier did at the end. You can even see by his emotion and the way he acted, it's almost like it's I've arrived a moment in Miami. Like that's what it felt like to me.
Right.
When he hit that second one in particular, how good that must have felt for him. It was kind of like, yeah, okay, this is how it's going to be now. And I think that's a great thing for them going into here down the stretch.
100%. And that's what kind of what I was getting at with Rozier about, you know, the watching him last night and that shot making. You need a freedom to take those. You need a freedom, and you have to fit in with your team and have their trust. And last night, maybe it was because they were shorthanded, but he played like a guy that believed he had the freedom to do though in those moments. We were talking earlier, this is my last point on this game, but we were talking earlier in the week about Steve Kerr and the job he has, because the gap between Golden State's fourth and fifth best player and sixth and seventh best player is really thin. And that's a hard thing. I don't think there's a coach in the NBA that does a better job of balancing that than Eric Spoelstra. Every single night they play these guys. I mean, last night it was Orlando Robinson, right? You start Thomas Bryant, you play Orlando Robinson, but they just have guys in there every single night that are different. And he seems to always have his finger on the pulse of tonight. It's for this guy in this moment, who's playing well. I'm going to go here. I'm going to go to this lineup. That's one of his skills. And it's one of the most important skills in basketball. It takes a culture of everybody accepting that your roles can change night to night. Your minutes can change night to night, but it also takes a coach that just seems to know exactly, okay, this is the combo of guys the team needs.
And the other thing Eric Spoelstra does really well, and this is behind the scenes, and nobody's going to see this because it takes place on the off days. It takes place on the practice facility. It takes place on the charters. It takes place, in a quiet moment after a film session. He communicates with every guy on that team in a way that keeps them ready and keeps them feeling important, even if they're not necessarily getting big minutes or they're in the rotation at the time. And that goes a long way, because I have seen it where coaches, particularly as you get later into the year, they're honed in on their top 8-9 guys because like every night is so stressful and they're trying to win games or whatever. And they kind of lose touch a little bit with some of those guys, and you just never know when you're going to need them. And Spo does a great job of making sure that they feel included no matter what's going on at the time with their particular minutes and their circumstances, so that when guys are called upon, they're ready to go and they feel like, I've been a part of this all along. Like, I'm important here. And I think that's just a communication thing and a leadership quality that Eric Spoelstra has.
Yeah. All right, let's move on now. Let's do a little Throwback Thursday today, since it is March Madness. Throwback Thursday, Emma, fired up, presented by DraftKings Sportsbook. What do we have here? Oh, my goodness. Legs, what do we have here, man? A throwback.
Look at this. Look at this. J.R. Tucker High School, baby. Richmond, Virginia. That is, I believe that I can't, I don't know. I think that's going into my senior year, which as you can see, I probably needed to eat a few more steaks. I was a little skinny. I had the reach of Manute Bol, apparently. And I have ginormous hands, which you can't really see in that particular picture. But yeah, man. And I also had, listen, I know you guys might be laughing at the haircut. That's how guys are wearing their hair. So relax. Get off me. All right. I'm not too proud of it.
You but, look like Spinoli. What is it from Ridgemont, Fast Times at Ridgemont High? Spinoli, right?
Spicoli.
Yeah, Spicoli. Spicoli. There it is. Yeah, Spicoli.
But, man, this was – so that was going into my senior year, and I know where we're going with this, like talking about the NCAA tournament. And, like, that's kind of where all that started to come into play for me. Like, I was a late bloomer to the game, late even picking it up. And each year just made incredibly dramatic improvements in my game in high school to the point where going into my junior year, I was on the radar at all for schools yet. After my junior year, I went to five-star camp, which was like the camp to go to up in Pittsburgh at Robert Morris. I went up to this camp, kind of an unknown guy, played really well there, got put on the map. I go from like kind of like, you know, I had a good junior year, but I wasn't on anybody's radar. Even the schools in the state, Richmond, Virginia Tech, VCU, like none of those, University of Virginia, none of those schools. And then I was a first-team all-state player my senior year. Like that's how much, and that's right there when that picture was taken. It was like before the season. That's when it was all happening for me. And that's when I really started thinking for the first time about, like, you know, where I was going to go to school and playing in the NCAA tournament one day and all of those things. It kind of took root right there in Richmond.
I love it. I also just love, so the people listening to this, you have the you know, the 70s, 80s pose for basketball. Because nowadays, guys have to put the ball. They have to kind of give a scowl. They have to do this. You're in your defensive stance. You know, you got down. I love it, man. You don't see those
back
anymore.
Back then, the two stances were going to be either that, like palms up, defense, or that one we always got into where you put, like, your right foot forward, left foot back, and the ball's, like, on your hip. Like,
triple threat position,
right? That was the two standard basketball poses at the time.
So true, man. How'd you end up in LaSalle?
Ended up in LaSalle, flat out recruited everybody. And I can say, like, they had an incredible staff. Like, guy named Lefty Irvin was the head coach. A lot of people probably haven't heard of Lefty Irvin, but he was the head coach. But the two assistants did all the legwork. Joe Mihalik, who went on to be a longtime head coach at Niagara, Hofstra. He's actually back at LaSalle now helping out. And then Fran Dunphy, who a lot of people have heard of, was the other assistant. He went on to coach for years at Penn. He took, I don't know how many times he took Penn to the tournament, probably like six times. He took Temple to the tournament numerous times after that. He's actually now back as the head coach at LaSalle. So they brought back those two guys to LaSalle as we speak. But
that's awesome.
Here's what the difference was, Adam. The difference back then and now is this. Back then, AAU wasn't really a thing. It was just starting out. So if you wanted to see a player, you had to go to their games. And from LaSalle to Richmond, it was about 4.5-hour drive from Philly to Richmond. So they could go to as many games as they wanted to. They could go to as many of my practices as they wanted to. And I rarely recall looking up at a game or a practice when someone from LaSalle's staff was not in our gym. Wow. And as a result, they just started to impress upon me that, like, they just want me more. And just developed a really personal relationship with them and my father and my mom. Like, it was like a second set of parents, you know. So we were just like this family. They became extended family, and really that was important to me. I also loved, by the way, on my visit, I went to the Palestra for a doubleheader. It's the greatest basketball environment in the country, and I was blessed to play all of my home games. We shared that gym with Penn, and so we went to a doubleheader. It was 9,000 people. Every seat was filled. They were on right on top of you. They threw the streamers on the court after the first basket. The environment, and, oh, by the way, all the city schools were good. Temple, St. Joe's, Villanova, LaSalle, they were all really good programs. The environment was so intense. And I was like, this, you add it all up, and I made my decision on my official visit that that's where I wanted to go. And I think I broke some hearts of the some of the coaches of those schools I mentioned in Virginia, because by that time, they were all over me. And they didn't want me to get out of state, but it was too late. Yeah. I'd already developed these relationships with LaSalle, who got in there a little bit earlier.
That's great, man. That's awesome. One of these days, I'm going to ask you about basketball environments, and I'm going to ask you about regions of sports, New York versus LA versus Chicago versus DMV, because I love that question. But we're going to save that for another show. Now, I want to ask about these March Madness teams and who some of your favorites have been over the years. Because college basketball, to me, I'll just go to spoil this, has fallen off a little bit. We'll talk about that in a second with the one-and-done rule and maybe even some of the NIL stuff. It's just it's not what it was in the 80s, 90s, in those eras. My favorite team, I'll go ahead and start off the top here. My favorite team was the 03 Kansas team that featured Kirk Heinrich and Nick Collison. I wore number 40 my whole career because of Nick Collison's Kansas tenure. They lost to Melo in the finals. I remember it was crushing. And then my Nuggets drafted Melo right after that. So it kind of ended up becoming full circle for me. But that was one of my favorite teams. I loved the Florida team with Al Horford and Joakim Noah, Corey Brewer. That was a phenomenal team to watch. Won a couple championships. What are some of your favorite college squads and March Madness squads? I'll say these have to be teams that made something in the tournament.
Well, I'll go back to when I was young, and I was – the first 12 years of my life, I lived in Baltimore before we moved to Richmond. And so I was in ACC country, any way you slice it. And even though I didn't play organized basketball because I was mainly a baseball player, I loved watching it, and I loved watching the ACC. And it was so awesome then because there were eight teams in the league, and it was the same eight teams every single year.
Right.
And so you not only – and I was a Maryland Terrapins fan because I was in Baltimore. So my favorite – college basketball players of all time are Len Bias, Albert King. Mm. Those were my guys growing up. And the ACC tournament was the greatest event in the calendar year for me at the time, just watching the ACC and watching Maryland and hoping they could make a run and get through that and get to the tournament. As obviously it was a lot different. It was harder to get those at-large bids from those conferences. So you knew you had to have at least two wins in the ACC tournament to have a chance, you know, when I was a Maryland fan. But here's the other thing, Adam. Having an eight-team conference where it was the same teams every year, Duke, Carolina, Clemson, Virginia, Georgia Tech, right? You also, not only did you love your team, you hated those teams. And you hated them because you knew the players because they were there for 4 years for the most part.
There's no hate like college sports hate. There's no hate like college sports hate. That's the top hate in sports.
I hated North Carolina. I can't tell you how much I hated University of North Carolina. Number one, it was like impossible for Maryland, like never beat them.
Yeah,
Carolina, this was pre-shot clock days. And by the way, I went back this morning. I was trying to remember. I knew I had the score. I couldn't remember the year. Carolina would slow the ball down with the four corner and all that. Do you know they played a game against Duke in 1979 in the regular season, and the score of the game at halftime was 7-0.
7-0. What are we doing? 79?
In 1979. And the thing was, Carolina was trying to hold the ball, but Duke had the 7-0 lead. Because they got a couple of turnovers and a couple of bad. But and Carolina would do that kind of garbage against Maryland. They'd get a lead, then they'd hold the ball, and it was driving me insane. So I never hated anybody like Carolina. Now, here's the thing, though. I go to LaSalle, and now, obviously, you're all about LaSalle. So then when I leave LaSalle, I became a pro and I'm like chasing my dream and all that. You kind of lose the vitriol for those programs after going through college basketball. And also, it's not like I loved Maryland as much anymore, man. I went to LaSalle. So it's like you kind of lose that. But growing up, I had my Nerf hoop in my bedroom, man. And I was imitating all those ACC players that were coming through on my Nerf hoop, dreaming about it one day. And, So those are some of my greatest memories growing up, man, was college basketball.
You know, that Maryland team, Juan Dixon, Lonnie Baxter, I'm trying to think. They had one other big name on it, and I'm trying to think of who it was.
Steve Blake.
Yeah, Steve Blake was on it. That was a really fun team, too. I remember liking that one a lot.
Absolutely. And Scott Van Pelt, as everybody knows, is a Maryland alum and a huge hoops guy. And so that's like his favorite team of all time. So we talk about that all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, and then your other podcast partner, J.J. Redick, obviously on an iconic Duke team that you were either pro-Duke or anti-Duke. I think I was anti-Duke at the time. I don't really have a dog in the fight now. Are there any other teams?
I do have one team that, you know, and I always – by the way, this time of year, my thing is I will jump on those underdog bandwagons like you've never seen somebody, man. Like you give me a St. Peter's from last year, and I'm going to be all in on watching St. Peter's. So I'm really looking forward to today. Hopefully we have some of those upsets. I'd love to see them. But I will give you one college team that I absolutely loved, and it was a personal connection. It was the Loyola Marymount team with Paul Westhead, that made an Elite Eight run. And they, you know, that's, this was, you know, they had Bo Kimmel, Hank Gathers, and then, you know, Hank Gathers died playing in a college basketball game. Those guys are Philly guys. So like in the summers, we were all playing pickup ball together. So I knew all of those guys. Paul Westhead is a Philly guy. He was the head coach of that team. He ended up being my head coach in Denver years later. But that team, they made the run, and Hank had passed, and they made the run, and Bo Kimble was shooting free throws left-handed in honor of Hank Gathers. Like, that whole thing, that was definitely a team that I had a lot of emotion for that wasn't, you know, my alma mater.
Yeah. I liked Fred Van Fleet's Shockers. You know, they made a nice little run that year. I liked
Wichita State. Yeah.
Yeah, Wichita State. I like that team. How they played. And then Nova's had some teams I've enjoyed playing lately as well over the last decade.
Well, I got a good, I got a real quick story. The 85 national champs, Villanova. I was a freshman at LaSalle that year. Villanova just barely beat us in the regular season. They had another freshman on their team, and I was a freshman shooter. He was a freshman shooter for Nova named Harold Jensen.
Who, love these stories.
In the national championship game, so I'm sitting in my dorm, and watching Villanova, I hated Villanova more than anything. I just got there for 1 year, and everybody knew to hate Villanova. I hated them. And here they are. We're watching this, and they get to the national championship game. They're playing Georgetown. I don't know what the spread on the game was. I think Nova was a 10 seed. They're playing a team that literally virtually looks unbeatable. And if you recall, they shoot like 80% from the field in the second half. It's one of the greatest upsets in the history of college basketball. Harold Jensen, I believe in that game, went 6 for 6 from the field. And it's like hitting all these big shots. And I'm sitting there in my dorm just seething because I'm like, this dude, are you kidding me? He's going to win a national championship. And then here's what's funny. Fast forward, Adam. Yeah. So I compete against the guy for the next 3 years. But then we graduate, we go our separate ways. I made it to the league. He did not. He became very successful in business. Fast forward, I'm like 40 years old. I'm out of the NBA. And I get a phone call from a guy putting a league together, a team together in a really good men's league in Philly. And I'm like, yeah, I'll play. You know, who else is on the team? He starts listing names. And Harold Jensen's on the team. And I'm like, get out of here. So Harold Jensen and I reunited, and we bonded, and we were like teammates. That's all awesome. In for each other. You know, this was like 20-something years after we had, you know, competed against each other and hated each other and played in a men's league in Philadelphia. That won the championship of that league, so I did get my title.
I love it, man. You have great stories, Legs. Legs, I said this on Twitter one time. Great storyteller, man. I love these old ones, these old school stories. Let me, and also I could just tell, people could tell this if you're listening. It comes out every now and then. You are so competitive, and I love it because I'm super competitive as well. But I hear these stories every now and then. I'm in my dorm room. See, I just, because I know it's true. I know you're actually sitting in your dorm room just looking up at the ceilings, sitting there just ruminating. So I love it. Let me ask you this, and we got to get out of here on this one, but. You know, college basketball has obviously changed for a lot of reasons, probably inevitable in a lot of ways how much it's changed. But the pipeline of college to the pros, I think, is one of the reasons that basketball became so popular. There were storylines that started in college and completed in the NBA. And Magic and Larry are obviously maybe the most iconic example of that. But there's so many other stories where it's like, hey, we know this guy because we saw them in college. There was a storyline coming in. That's obviously broken in the last 15, 20 years, and I don't think there's any going back. But I think the NBA misses it, both from how does the public access the NBA? Like, I think it's lessened the popularity of basketball as a sport and the NBA in particular. But I also just think the product. There are a lot of things you learn. Even though the college and NBA games have gone different directions, they're almost different. They're almost different sports. They're different games for sure. I still think there's a lot of things that players learn at those levels that they don't learn now. I sound like the old guy now, but I'm just curious how much you agree with that, that schism between college and the NBA has hurt the product.
I think so, but I don't think that's the biggest. I don't think that's the biggest reason for me. It's subjective, but here's what I think. Like I mentioned a little bit ago, I think the expansion of these conferences to this many teams and the combined with the player turnover has literally turned it into, unless you are an alum of one of those schools where you're going to know the guys on the team every year, right? If you're a passionate alum of the school, you're always going to know the roster where these guys came from. But like I said before, I used to know all the players on the other teams in my team's league. And so you develop almost this weird relationship with those guys too. And now that's just not the case. It's impossible to follow and maintain knowledge of the rosters of the schools in your conference. Number one, some of these conferences have 16 teams. And so that alone, plus the turnover between transfer portal where guys can just bounce around, go wherever they want to. Now the NIL, what that's become and how you're trying to attract players in the first place. I just think it's created this, just 1,200 to 1,500 guys in the transfer portal as we sit here. I just think it's created the situation where the turnover is so great, you're losing track of like who's who. And as a result, the rivalries are disappearing. You still have the ones that are like in state or in league. Those are always going to exist. Oklahoma, Oklahoma State. Yeah, obviously that's going to be a big game. But guess what? Back when I was talking about like Maryland, Carolina was a rivalry. But so was Maryland, Wake Forest. So was Maryland, Clemson. Like, and that just doesn't really exist as much anymore. And the players aren't there for 3 or 4 years to build up a genuine dislike of another guy on the other team. They're just not there to that extent. So I think for me, that has been the biggest difference in following college basketball and being as passionate about it. Now, look, they always have the saving grace of the tournament, and it is going to bail them out every year because there's nothing like it. The one-and-done format, the tension of the moment, like everything you did in the regular season meaning nothing if you find yourself in a one-possession game with 4 minutes to go against a 15 seed. All that's out the window. Like all of that, they created something that's impossible to replicate in any other sport, really. So that will always bail out their regular season. But I do think the regular season has become harder and harder to stay locked in and invested in emotionally the way that I did when I was younger. And I think a lot of people feel that way about college basketball.
I think you're right. But you know what? You sold me on the tournament, so I'm going to go watch it right now down at the DNVR bar. Legs, another great show, man. This one was a lot of fun. And we got to see an old picture of you, a high school photo of you.
Well, next time we're going to have one of me. I'm going to get a picture. We're going to show of me cutting down the nets in the conference tournament my senior year at LaSalle to allow us to play in my one NCAA tournament my senior year. I want to get that picture.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. All right, everybody, thanks so much for tuning in. Tomorrow we've got Nuggets-Knicks. That should be a great game. We've got Pelicans-Magic. That one should be a great game. So it should be another good one. And who knows? Maybe the tournament gives us something to talk about as well. Thanks for hanging out with us, guys. Hit that like button on the way out. We'll see you tomorrow.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.